So zero carbon Australia stationary energy plan. Stationary energy is the lights for the projector and the laptop and for aluminium smelter, you know, power for aluminium smelters. So that's electricity. Energy also includes transport, liquid fuels, and space and water heating, which is often delivered by gas, but not always. So that's, we're talking all energy. So we need some context. We've seen the 2020 and some eyebrows are raised, and why 2020? Well, there's quite a number of reasons, but here's probably the best one because it's where the science is at. This is from Professor Hans-Joachim Schellenhuber. He's Angela Merkel's science advisor. He's the EU's science advisor, and he's at the Potsdam Institute of Climate Research. And here's a presentation he gave last year, and he said that starting with an unfair base of 2010 and allocating equal per capita emissions to countries, where we need to be to have a 67% chance of avoiding a 2-degree global average warming. And that's actually sort of, you know, many people say 2 degrees is actually too high. And 2 degrees could regionally mean 5 degrees or 6 degrees in some location. It could mean in a peak day, instead of having the highest, hottest temperature at 47, suddenly you've got 53. It could mean that for a regional spot. So it's pretty extreme. It could mean the drying out of land and not being able to use it for the same agricultural purpose or any agricultural purpose in the future. So here you've got United States, and you can see that United States and their current emissions, that allocating that to each person, they need to be decarbonised by 2020. So it's a pretty significant change to their economy that they have to go through. But we have basically a very similar emissions profile to the United States. So you can follow that USA curve there and say what Australia needs to do. So that's what the science says Australia needs to do to have a sufficient or less than sufficient chance of exceeding 2 degrees Celsius. And 67%, I wouldn't hop on a aeroplane and come to Canberra, you've only had a 67% chance of getting here. There's more than one aeroplane and more than one of me, but there's only one planet, okay? So anyway, there's a group of really well-organised, well-researched, well-resourced people on climate change and climate science. They're walking the halls of parliaments around the country. They know every politician. There's a few dozen of them per politician, and unfortunately, it's not us. It's the Can't Do campaign. And the Can't Do campaign sing the Can't Do mantra. And the Can't Do mantra goes, renewable energy can't supply baseload, renewable energy is too expensive, renewable energy will wreck the economy, and renewable energy will cost jobs. And if they say it enough, the marketing people tell them, you'll believe it as fact, because something is said a lot, it must be true. So that was obviously an issue for us because we take a sort of more rational approach and realise that renewables can do the job, and you know, we've proven that. So we put together the Can Do team, and the Can Do team counters the Can't Do team. It's people all ages, but particularly you can think of as bright young people who work in industry, academia, government, regulatory roles. They're trying to, you know, they're engineers and scientists, they're mechanical engineers, automotive engineers, they work in car plants, they work in fossil fuel facilities, but they're designing the future they want to work in. So they're coming to the Zero Carbon Australia project, and they're doing the research because, you know, by day they might work boringly at ExxonMobil doing what they don't like, but at night time they're saying, well, as soon as we get this design and get the government into action and get the Australian people behind it, we'll be working in a solar thermal plant, which I'll tell you about in a sec. So we've got a couple of strategic research partnerships, and we're hoping to establish more. We've got the University of Melbourne Energy Research Institute, which we released this project with, and we now employ, a number of people are now employed who are Zero Carbon Australia Research Fellows working on our projects with, and the Melbourne Sustainable Societies Institute, which also covers land use and transport. So Beyond Zero Emissions itself is volunteer run. We've got a big pro bono research team, over 100 people. Pro bono communications team, it's no good to create a report, sit it on a shelf. We're about creating it and launching 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 it until we release version 2 and then launching that, okay? So we're totally independent. We're not beholden by trade, government or lobby groups. We're run on donations, so just people like you, mums and dads, people giving us $20 a month. That's really important to us. We've got paid staff who coordinate volunteers. So they're people who have the expertise that they could actually do the research, but they spend 70% of their time, that's our target, coordinating, you know, 10 or 15 volunteers per paid research coordinator. So Zero Carbon Australia project is a big project. It's not just the stationary energy plan. It's transport, it's buildings, it's industrial processes, it's land use, and it's replacing coal or fossil fuel export revenue. Got to update that. It's supposed to say fossil fuel. Follow-on documents. So for each of these plants, so these are your blueprints. So they just sort of show you technically how you go from today to decarbonised in the sector. We have a policy options document that will first be coming out for stationary energy. And that's to sort of say what sort of policy options work around the world and how you would implement them here. And what's working here, ACT could be an example. Research directions, showing universities where they say where things could be improved and it would be good to focus research efforts and dollars, and also what in Australia is already in the right area and what should be boosted to try and sort of split the wheat from the chaff there. And commercialisation opportunities, so what's on the cusp of commercialisation. So most of the research has been done. It just needs that boost to get out of the valley of death and across the line. So we try and really separate that out, but we stick to commercially available now in our technical blueprints. And we might have some questions around why we have or haven't included technologies, and a lot of it goes back to that. Some of those need to be in commercialisation opportunities. So we've, in terms of communications, we do things like Q&A. This is with Kate Blanchett. Introduced the greening of the wharf, which was a huge PV array they put on the wharf theatre, and Tony Jones ran a Q&A. We had Shengrong Shi, the Sun King from SunTech, UNSW educated, and now is the biggest solar PV manufacturer in the world. Bob Carr and Graham Bradley up there from the Business Council of Australia, who you can see even at the beginning of the show wanted to get out of there. and after I dealt with him. Also, you might have seen Dr. Carl. He's been speaking on Triple J and on Sunrise a couple of times. He's got a plan for 100% renewables. It's $37 billion a year. Pretty confident it's the same as our plan. It's got the same pictures and same figures, but it's Dr. Carl's. But we can only endorse Dr. Carl on this. If more people get a plan like this, you know, if Martin Ferguson got Martin Ferguson's plan and wanted to run with it, you know, all his. Okay. We're lucky to interview on our radio program. We run a couple of radio programs to get access to experts around the world because everyone wants to be interviewed. And we're lucky to get David Suzuki, and he's got $2 million and he's going to launch Zero Carbon Canada based on our project. So that's pretty exciting. And we'll be doing some consulting for him to tell him how to sort of employ the right people to coordinate it and how to generate the buzz to get the pro bono research happening and get the linkages with people in universities and industry. That's pretty exciting. And presented this to the International Energy Agency on the 15th of January, and they wrote it up on their website. That's this here. So we've definitely been getting it out across the globe, and in particular here in Australia. And this is, look, I always wanted a solar thermal plant. It wasn't quite the one I wanted, but it's almost as good, and it's a 400-to-1 scale, and we have a fantastic volunteer who's got much patience or Asperger's or something, and he put that together, and I'll show you what the real thing looks like. So that's there. And that's the real thing, so, you know, they're kind of identical. size difference, but, yeah, that's pretty cool. Anyway, so back to the 10-year question. Look, Al Gore had it all written wraps. You know, we've got this single scenario. We've explored a scenario. Of course, other scenarios could play out. But Al Gore says, a political promise to do something 40 years from now is universally ignored because everyone knows that it's meaningless. 10 years is about the maximum time that we as a nation can hold a steady aim and hit our target. So if you talk about 2050, that means do nothing until 2040. If you talk about 2030, it means do nothing until 2020 and so on. So we need to do something now. From a project management perspective, 10 years is realistic. That's about being realistic. Beyond 10 years is not realistic. And Mark Jacobson, we fit well within his plan, which was featured on the front page of Scientific American back in November 2009, and he's actually re-released it since, but I can't remember where. He's done a plan for the whole world at a higher level to be 100% renewable by 2030, which would involve 3.8 million large wind turbines and 90,000 solar plants. Those numbers would actually be lower if they used some of the technology we chose in our project. So we fit well within that 2030 timeframe because you need to get developing countries over the line and places like China as well. And we've got it relatively easy here in Australia. So the key technology to getting this done in an Australian context is concentrating solar thermal power. And here you've got a solar thermal plant in Spain. And this is how they work. So you've got two tank salt system. This is a molten salt power tower. You've got a cold salt tank and a hot salt tank. Surrounding a big tower, which is like a smokestack but with no smoke coming out of the top, you've got a field of mirrors, a sea of mirrors, and each of those mirrors individually tracks where the sun is and bounces the sun's rays up to the top of the tower. molten salt, potassium nitrate and sodium nitrate in a binary mix. He's pumped up the tower and receives the light from the sea of mirrors as heat, as it hits the receiver at the top, and then drops down and is banked in the hot salt tank. So the cold salt tank goes down during the day and the hot salt tank goes up. Then any time, day or night, you don't even have to do it in the middle of the day if you don't need to, water is run past a heat exchanger, a shell and tube heat exchanger, flashes to steam, and then drives a conventional turbine, the same one that's in a coal-fired power plant. And you've got 290-degree cold salt here, so 290 degrees, it freezes at 220, so they keep it healthily above that, and then it becomes 565-degree hot salt at the other side. So when it goes through the heat exchanger, it gets banked back in the cold tank again, ready for receiving the sun's energy for the next day. This allows you to dispatch electricity whenever you need it. It can be run in base load operation where you just run it flat out, or it can complement first dispatch renewable energy sources such as solar photovoltaic and wind, which is what we'd want to be doing, so you can have the firming power and the energy security you need to provide a modern grid with 100% renewables. There's really only two technologies that can do this kind of thing right now. It's pumped hydro storage and solar thermal with storage.
And what happens when that gets hit by a tsunami?
Well, firstly, unlike nuclear plants where they want a lot of water for obvious reasons, because they've been desperately trying to get a lot of water into their nuclear plants, if I use the analogy, it just came to mind when you said that. Actually a very serious, sad situation. You don't really put these on the coast, so I think the risk would more, in Australian context, be a cyclone rather than a tsunami, so you'd want to make sure that you're sufficiently inland to make sure your winds aren't going to be above about 160 kilometres an hour, which is what they're kind of rated at. And I'm not sure if that's winds or gusts. So gusts means...
I've been asking about safety concerns.
Oh, safety concerns?
Of the salt.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so the salt is potassium nitrate, sodium nitrate mixture. It's the same stuff that gets stored in on farms and stuff like that. In this case, it's actually... surrounded by a buffer of a kilometre or two of mirrors, depending on the size of the plant. Whereas at a farm, it's kind of up the end of the road, and it's fertiliser. So in the United States, you don't need a special EPA licence to actually commission this plant with the salt. In fact, one of the advantages, they say, of not hybridising and adding gas is that they have lots less in terms of licensing because they don't have the emissions to deal with, because it's already considered a benign thing for farming and agriculture.
So you won't get... radiation.
Well, look, there's me handling the potassium nitrate. You wouldn't want to, inject it, but you wash your hands afterwards. I've heard you could eat a bit of it, but you wouldn't want to take like a full handful. Okay, it regulates your body, as salt does. But this particularly. So yeah, look, treat it with care, but I wouldn't be doing that with uranium or plutonium or something. So yeah, relatively benign, but I'm not saying it's without any caution required, but it doesn't need an EPA license, which gives you a bit of an idea as to what it's like. And that's 300 kilometres south of Spain, south of Madrid, where they're commissioning a plant, and I've got the Haifa Multi K, the same stuff that goes into fertiliser. It's called Multi K, for. And this is Pat, he's our technical director. He's the Australia's first zero carbon research fellow. He's the guy we found wandering aimlessly around the ExxonMobil refinery. I said, I'll offer you half your pay. And he said, I'm in. So there he's like a pig in shit at a solar thermal plant. There's some storage containers there, and he's much happier in this environment, in his natural environment, than in the toxic environment of an oil refinery. So this is not prototypes, okay? So when we hear about hot rocks geothermal or wave power, I'm more bullish on wave than hot rocks geothermal, by the way, they're at prototype stage. So in other words, they haven't got to commercialisation stage. They could be on the cusp of commercialisation, perhaps Carnegie wave power, so that'd be a commercialisation opportunity. But the pilots of this was 1978, the USSR built C3-C5 in the Crimea at 5 megawatts direct steam. So it got affected by cloud transients and nighttime. And then the Americans thought, man, those Russians have done 5 megawatts, we'll do 10 megawatts in 1981. And then the French go, oh, we can't really one up you on big, but we'll be smarter. And they put storage in with salt. And then you did that in 1982. So, and then the Americans got, damn those French. And they added more mirrors, they converted Solar One, their plant that had 10 megawatts, and added, and made it run for 4 hours without light. And it's Sandia National Laboratories, the guys who gave us the nuclear bombs in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Lockheed Martin, Bechtel, Boeing. So these are guys who sort of, you know, bomb people, but they do solar on the side, okay? So they're not hippies, okay? So they're into, like, high temperature and all that sort of stuff, and they're pretty good at it, and we want to really focus their efforts in this area. So there's a good way to solve war as well if they can get their head out of the other space into this one. So out of that, look, the Bush administration tried to sort of close down the solar programs, so a complete copy of all the, and even Bechtel gave it away, of everything they'd done with the USDOE went to the Spanish, and their biggest engineering company, Senair, that did the Spanish nuclear plants. They do the cross between, say, Worley Parsons and Lockheed Martin. They do satellites up in the sky, and they're the biggest engineering company. So they do the designs on them in Spain. And Solar Reserve, which is United Technologies Corporation, they're the guys who do Pratt & Whitney jet engines. So half of the world's aeroplanes are in the sky because of their high temperature ability with jet engines. They do these modern salt power towers. So two competitors doing the same thing, basically. ACS is the construction contractor. They own Hochtief, which owns Leighton Holdings. So very strong tie to Australia. If Leighton Holdings' parents can do it, then Leighton Holdings can build these. And Worley Parsons is the on-site engineering company for Solar Reserve. So they're our biggest engineering company. So my contention here, my argument is that obviously we can do this in Australia. In Spain, there's about seven plants running with 7.5 hours storage at the moment. Most of them actually built by ACS. Here you can see Andesol 1 and 2, Extrasol 1, Samca, with 7.5 hours storage. Now, these are parabolic troughs. These have been around since the 80s in California. The reason we didn't choose this technology, they're good for gaming summer peak demand, but when the winter sun is low on the horizon, they don't lift up to go perpendicular to the sun's incidence. So they actually perform relatively badly in winter. And that's why they're only spec'd out with 7.5 hours of storage. But you get dishes, or which aren't commercial, or in this case towers, which is almost like a representation of a dish, but on a much bigger flat field. You can then have that elevation tracking and have pretty good winter performance. So this plant here, Hemisola, is 15 hours of energy storage, 75% capacity factor. So comparison, this is about, you know, if you want to define base load, New South Wales coal fleet average is 63%. So in other words, 63% of the hours of the year, or 63% of 8,760 hours, they deliver in full output. This plant delivers 75% spec. So it's more hours operating than a New South Wales coal plant. So this is a base load power plant, or if you want it to be, depending on how you adjust the salt ratio to the field and things like that, it can be a peaking plant and so on. And this is what a heliostat looks like. There's Rebecca, myself, and Pat, 130 square metres. That's the size of my house, and it's a pretty big mirror, and you have a field of 10,000 of them, or up to 17,000 of those surrounding a tower. It gets pretty hot at the top. This is not at the top because it's too hot. It's a bit under the top, and lucky the computer doesn't go haywire and, you know. So light's rays are focused at the top. That's actually the sun shining through dust, and you can see that sort of fantastic look at the back, especially see it from afar in this picture. And we didn't digitally touch it up. That's actually because of the dust, and 500 times the sun shining through dust gives you that sort of glow off the dust there. And this is a Hemisola when it was under construction, and around September the 27th or something?
Yeah.
And there we are at the top of the tower, and you can see the pedestals aren't finished yet. And this is what it looked at the time around September. You can see that one quarter of the field's not laid out. Then we get to December the 2nd, and the mirror field's finished, so it's pretty quick.
Where is this?
This is between Córdoba and Sevilla in Spain. And it's a great plant. That's what it looks like from up the viewing platform. And this is interesting. These are stamped out in the car component factory, just like the inside of a door, to minimise the amount of steel, because economics are around concrete, steel and glass. You want to use the minimum. And this is a $20 billion rollout over the next 3 years in Spain, $20 billion. So it's not tut-tut, a few solar panels in the local school, and I won't use that against ACT because your solar panel program is a bit more serious than that, but you know, most of the stuff in Australia is. It's kind of like a good photo opportunity or something. This is industrial mobilisation to solar thermal, and I think they might start ramping things a bit now, because they're going to be turning off a lot of nuclear plants in Spain now, because they've got some really old ones, and the old ones are not looking too favoured at the moment. So there, you've got $20 billion worth of solar thermal plants, over 50 facilities there under construction. So that brings us to the report. It's endorsed by the Renewable Energy Division of the International Energy Agency, Robin Batterham, the former Chief Scientist of Australia, Peter Gration, the former Chief of Defence, Augustus Nossal, Nobel Laureate Peter Doherty, and many more. Mark Jacobson from Stanford, who I mentioned before. And there's about a third of our endorsements in the front of the book. Couldn't fit them all in there. So we need to, when we're looking at this plan, we need to look at the demand case. And we take an all-energy approach. And if you consider renewable energy targets in Australia, think, okay, we've got a 20% renewable energy target. What does that mean? Well, it's 20% in electricity sector. You're welcome to come in. Yep, just take a seat. There's one here. 20% renewable electricity target. But if you actually look at, and we think, oh, yeah, we're the same as the rest of the world. Well, that's wrong. China and Europe, let's go to Europe. Europe has a 20 by 20 by 20. They have 20% all energy target. So firstly, they go 20% in liquid fuels for transport, 20% in electricity, 20% in space and water heating. So it's much more significant. China has a 15% target, and we worked out what that would mean, their 15% all energy target in China for not using non-fossil fuel. We worked out what that would mean in Australia. If you just compress that and just did it in the electricity sector, it would be the same as Australia having a 70% renewable electricity target. That's what China's doing today. Equivalent of Australia having a 70% renewable electricity target. So we look at all energy. And this blue is currently the lights and the laptop and the current electrical services. And you can see from today, we go up a little bit and then we start to drop. We know we might have to delay this a year because it hasn't started yet. So it might be a 2021 plan now, but we'll keep on to it. Hopefully it won't be beyond a 2025 plan. So we come down, we actually come down to an absolute reduction in end-use electricity in Australia through massive energy efficiency mining program. And you might think, well, that's a bit ambitious. We've been growing at 1.6% per annum. How on earth are you going to do that? Well, we know that at this point, Germany in 2020 is using less electricity per head of population than we are under this so-called extreme plan. It's so extreme that the Germans are more extreme in their sort of business as usual case than us. Okay, so that's our saving there. It's a significant saving against business as usual. You can take into account per capita growth and growth in population, and we've done that. And we're showing how that's achieved. In fact, in all the sectors of energy, in liquid fuels, in all energy sectors, we're showing how that's achieved in our buildings plan, in our transport plan that are currently being written, and we're relying on volunteers like you, if you've got expertise or interest in those areas, to help achieve that. The yellow area is other fuel electrification. It's switching gas, domestic gas, domestic commercial and industrial gas for industrial heat, for domestic and commercial space and water heating and so on, over to renewable ambient heat, renewable geosource heat, and electricity off the grid. So some heat pumps plus electric resistive heaters. And someone wants to ask me about heat pumps and things at the end. I'm happy to tell them about that. And just think reverse cycle air conditioners at the moment, running in the heating mode. And the red area there is transport electrification. So that's actually moving from liquid fuels, which are highly volatile and are going to cost the earth, to electrifying our cities with rail, so say 50% of passenger kilometres in cities, that's one person going 1 kilometre over to electric rail, and the remainder in pure electric and range-extending plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. So we model all that in our transport plan. So our end-use energy situation shows that at the moment oil is our predominant end-use of energy. This is not primary, this is after you've converted it. Although it's not exactly representative because we measured this at the bowser, not at the drivetrain where you get traction. Whereas we measure the electricity at the meter at people's houses, but even that is not, you can argue, you measure all over the place. But basically, we deliver less end-use energy for the same energy services. So you get the same warm house or even a more comfortable house, you get the same passenger kilometres, you go to the same places under this. It doesn't include behavioural elements unless you call, say, mode switching from a car to a train, but going the same route is a behavioural shift. And see, bioenergy goes up from sort of wood heating and things like that, gas burning goes up because we're mostly providing our renewed steel sector with direct reduced iron. So we replace the old economy blast furnaces and use what India uses all the new mills are based on. So when you hear BlueScope's chairman claim that you have to make steel with coking coal and so on, it's actually not true. And they know that all the new mills are direct reduced iron, but they don't want to tell anyone in Australia that because they'll look like they're the old guys. So How do we do it? 60% solar thermal with storage. Think of a site, we've got 12 of them with 19 smokestacks. So the same as a coal-fired power smokestack, no smoke coming out of the top. To give you an idea, in the Latrobe Valley, there's 23 smokestacks. So this will be, it's coming. There's 23 smokestacks in the Latrobe Valley, this will be 19. But of course, a lot healthier. And each of them are 217 megawatts net or 250 megawatts gross. So Hazelwood, for instance, in Victoria, has 188 megawatt net units and 200 megawatt gross units. So these are bigger than a unit of the Hazelwood, so just drop-in replacement for a coal plant virtually. Ability to store energy dispatch as needed. We've spec'd them with 17 hours of storage, and each site has 3,500 megawatts and 12 sites distributed across Australia. Wind, the remaining 40% of our energy, 6,500 turbines. We've gone for bigger turbines, 7.5 megawatt turbines, which means that there's less of them on the horizon, and you can't tell the difference between a big turbine and, say, a 1 megawatt turbine. A big turbine is a big turbine is a big turbine. Now, if you want to have arguments with, some of these anti-winders, if you want to have three times the arguments, we install the 2 megawatt turbines we install today. If you want to have a third of the arguments, we install the big ones. So if the wind industry was smart, they'd and the government was smart by leading that, they'd somehow incentivise the slight premium you pay on building the bigger turbines. The only difference is you see them from a little bit further afield, but apart from that, it's a big turbine, it's a big turbine, it's a big turbine. There's no reference on the horizon. Each wind region, 23 of them, will have 270 or 400 turbines. Already wind farms in Australia are proposed. In fact, one's even likely to get built with that sort of number of turbines, but not these big ones, unfortunately. And this is what they're like. This is in Belgium, me in front of them. As you can see, it just looks like a small turbine behind me, 7.5 megawatts. And you know, you couldn't tell the difference if I was in front of a 1 megawatt or a 7.5 megawatt. So to put that all together, we need a national grid. We worked with SKM on a high voltage DC backbone. We costed the grid. The grid's about 25% of the cost of our whole project. Now we've got high voltage DC backbone, which is low losses, so we can go 1,000 kilometres with only 3% losses. We've got rings to bring the wind in, so we're actually talking about planning to bring wind in, not just having the wind vendors to skirmish and fight over the last remaining rural transmission feeder, but actually, you know, planning to roll wind out, and we've got that all in there. So this is the renewable energy system that we could have if we chose to do so in 2020 or 2021. 12 solar regions, 23 wind regions. You can see the existing grid in white from Geoscience Australia. In the green is the high voltage AC links, and in the red, the high voltage DC, the same as Basslink. So that's what gives you a 100% renewable energy grid under our scenario. And this is what it looks like in terms of modelling. This is the demand. This is the wind power coming in, and it's actually not fair to wind power because we used real hub height data, but we only had data for South Australia, Victoria and Tasmania. We're now entering into non-disclosure agreements with wind prospecting companies in order to get data from Queensland, New South Wales and WA, which will show, where we know through all the studies around the world, will show less peaks and less troughs, which will be slightly easier to deal with. Not that we can't even deal with, we can deal fine with this situation on our grid. So this is the firm, so that's called first dispatch power from wind. We don't model PV on here because that's in our buildings plan. That just affects the demand profile at the top. Then we've got firming power from the energy security we need, the firming power from solar thermal with storage. So we've got those 200 turbines across those 12 sites, and we can have a whole lot of them running flat out and some of them ramping down in parallel. That allows us to dynamically match demand and the variance of the wind output. Existing hydro, that's existing hydro, it's tiny. And in green, we've got some bioenergy co-firing at some of the solar thermal plants. So we run the salt on a bypass loop, have an atmospheric pressure furnace, which is much cheaper than a steam furnace in a coal plant, and we're just heating that up. Now we reckon that with our, we're pretty confident that with our geographical diversity from the new winds monitoring sites, that will eliminate or significantly reduce the need for that bioenergy co-firing there. And then we can have it there as a contingency, so it can just be sort of an idle backup that's available in case meteorological conditions come that we didn't predict in, you know, modelling. And this is discarded, so this is power that we could have generated if someone had something to do with it at the time. So we've actually turned wind turbines out of the wind. We've remotely curtailed solar PV on people's roofs, or we've defocused mirrors at our solar thermal plants. But in our future versions of this, in version 2, if we can eliminate some of that, One way we're looking at that is pumped hydro storage at existing dam networks. Then we can save billions. There's like tens of billions of dollars of savings there. And so that's what we're working towards. So we see it as a big manufacturing and construction job. 600,000 heliostats per year. That's 148 square metre heliostat. We market and sell a million cars per year. A heliostat is a darn sight easier to manufacture than a motor car. So we have the capacity and capability. And you use car component type factories to do that job. That's what they're doing in Spain. And 30 concrete towers a year. Team of 20, continuous wet pour concrete, exactly the same size as the Loyang smokestack there. We could do them a bit more attractive, I suppose. And you go for 6 weeks and you pour one of those. So we can do 30 of those a year as well. So in terms of the manufacturing side, four of these factories that were built in Portugal will do the job. That took a year to build this Enercon factory. So you might go and build, you know, you pre-approve, say, an Enercon and a GE and a Siemens to provide their best quality turbines and get them to tool up, and then the wind vendors can choose from, the wind prospectors and that, and the developers can choose from that. We did a detailed labour and resource assessment. Here's the labour assessment. Today, in provisioning domestic energy, we have 20,000 people working in operations and maintenance. So they're the people at oil refineries, people working in domestic coal-fired power generators and the coal mines that feed those domestic coal-fired power plants. All that energy sector's there. Under our plan, it'll be 40,000 jobs. So you are paying a bit more for labour because you've got twice as many workers, but you don't have a line item for fuel cost. We're fully hedged. So if the cost of oil goes up around the world and gas follows it, and versus the gas scenario that we're getting fed at the moment by government and industry, our price doesn't go up, we're hedged. We're paying a small premium now, but we're going to lock in the price, and in fact, in the future, it's going to go down under a project like this. So you've got those workers, they're pretty static. Then at the top here, you've got the construction pulse, a peak of about 70,000 workers during the pre-GFC. We were growing construction at 50,000 workers per year, so we can peak our construction at 70,000 workers. It's well within the capability of the Australian economy. In terms of our skills and things like that, we're not going to try and develop and compete with lots of different plants. We're talking about using a model Senair and solar reserve plant and then stamping those out so that you're basically building the same thing. It's like building roads and you move the workforce from project to project, and that's where you get another 30% savings. Here's a labour in context of the market more generally from the government's own stats. 190,000 people work in mining and energy. And that includes iron ore exports, but also includes the 22,000 people in coal export-related jobs, LNG. And then up there, you can see the Zero Carbon Australia construction pulse. Contrast that with professional services, with construction and manufacturing. You can see manufacturing is huge. And in fact, these, you know, 190,000 people here, by pumping this sector and inflating the dollar, we're selling out the 800,000 people who work in manufacturing. So it's not ideal necessarily to go bull at a gate, especially for things we don't need, like coal and LNG, which we've proven we don't need. It's better to export those things and concentrate on mining and resources in things like lithium and iron ore and commodities that we need globally for humanity. So here we've got concrete. 8% of Australia's concrete equivalent to do the job over the 10 years. So expand concrete production by 8% or we find that much savings. Steel, it's about 20% of our current steel output. Although if you take net steel from iron ore exports, it's just a sliver in South Korean and Japanese mills and so on. We looked at neodymium and silver for the silvered mirrored glass mirror requirements. The only significant increase in capacity commodity-wise would be we'd need to double our glass production. And we looked at the cost of a similar line that went in India by Saint-Gobain Glass Company, and it cost $250 million, so it'd probably cost $1 billion to do the same job here in Australia, but that would also be built into the cost of glass, so that'd be fine. Cost reduction curves, the US Department of Energy did a 380-page detailed assessment on where cost reduction curves occur, things like moving workforce from one job to another, it's like a 30% saving, having your manufacturing working 24/6 days, like you have a car factory running at optimal, will get the cost down on the component side by 30%, then there's learnings and all that. And so we did that, we scaled it up to Australian circumstances, and we acted as though the rest of the stuff wasn't happening in Spain and the US and the Middle East and North Africa in order to be conservative with it. So we acted like the rollout they described was only happening in Australia, and that's how we came up with our numbers. To give you an idea of some of that saving, this is parabolic troughs, a technology we're not using, but it's a good example. Here you've got the space frame with those trusses, and they're welded, and it actually, because they're welded by hand, they flex, and you get 12% less efficient focus than this, which uses these ribs. And these ribs are stamped out in a car component factory, and they're all identical, and they've come all connected together in a big pile, and they have massive savings. In fact, 25% of the total plant capital cost, and that includes the steam turbine and the storage system, just by changing from that system to that system. So that's a massive reduction. It shows that feed-in tariffs are causing us to ride cost reduction curves through innovation. And here's that the team was doing 20 troughs per day of the old system, and was doing 80 troughs per day with the same team doing the new system with those ribs. So a much more lightweight structure, less steel, better focus, and so on. So I'll put it to you that safe climate is a bargain at less than 3% of GDP. It's $37 billion a year investment. It's the same as what we spend on insurance today. It's less than the $54 billion we spend on cars, for example. This is a $1,300 billion economy. We can expand in this way, and there'll be a whole lot of positive flow-on effects, and we'll get that. You can see that solar-thermal with storage is one of the more expensive components, that because it's less mature down the cost curve than, say, wind, which is doing a lot of that, a lot of the work. And in fact, in the future version, we might actually show that we can do 50% wind with marginally more curtailment, but that's actually a better deal than, if you just provided you can manage it, that is, than going as much solar thermal with storage. So your cost for transmission at about 25% of the cost. The backup heaters and the bioenergy supply might come down a bit in cost because we'll have them there for contingency, but less so for provisioning less than 2% of the energy at those solar thermal plants. So here's the story right now. This is from AGL, I'm only quoting AGL. Policy uncertainty means that we get no baseload gas. That's combined cycle gas turbines. Policy certainty, which they call $30 a tonne carbon price, they're sort of aiming for 25 to 50, is combined cycle gas turbines. Not much mention of renewables there. This presentation, when I watched it, told us how wind was going really well, and then he got down to the nuts and bolts throughout the wind talk, and started talking about the reality of what's about to happen with the carbon price. And here's the chart. It's 10,000 megawatt increase of combined cycle gas plants. What you've got to understand is if you build a combined cycle gas plant, you're only going to spend the capital on that multi-billion dollar asset. If you know you can run flat chat, you've got to sign up a deal with a gas provider, so you're going to provision you the pipeline and the gas to do that. It crowds out the space for renewables. So aside from the existing renewable energy target, right, stimulated stuff, by wedging gas like this into the market, you haven't got space for renewables. And if you do, you've got a sovereign risk issue for these guys, or you've got, you know, and I've heard some people who are trying not to, who say they're pro renewables, and they're trying not to, they're talking clean energy, and they're trying to say, well, the gas isn't that bad. They say things like, oh, well, these guys pay their gas plant off after 18 years. Now, I'm going to pay my house off after 25 years, but I don't expect the government to come and take it off me at year 26, okay? So when someone builds a gas plant today that they pay off in 18 years, they're going to want to run it for 60 years, because that's like, if they ever build a $2 billion asset and they can make money off it, you know, they'll write a check for $100 million to go into fight to protect a $2 billion asset. Because suddenly, in year 20, you want them to turn it off, and they own five of these, they've got $10 billion worth. You'd say to them, you want me to turn those off? Well, I can spend $500 million shutting you up, okay? So we've got to be careful not to grow our enemy. And that's what I'm concerned is happening with this forecast for so much gas. And that's just from the horse's mouth, AGL there. You can hear Grant King wanting $25 a tonne. So I put it to you that there's two paths presenting themselves. There's a gas future, which is a pure carbon price on its own. That's a gas future, it's nothing else. And if I had little recordings, I could get Combe going gas, and Julia going gas, and everyone going gas, and Grant going gas. Or it's a renewables future with a feed-in tariff, okay? Now, you can have a modest carbon price of $0 to $20 a tonne, $10 or $20 a tonne, plus your feed-in tariff, and that's pretty safe. But from $25 to $70 a tonne is a dead zone where you only get additional gas above the renewable energy target. And to make that clear, $25 to $70 a tonne is a dead zone for renewable energy. From $70 to $200, you get wind plus gas, more and more wind as you get closer to $200. And at $200 a tonne, you get wind plus baseload solar thermal plants. So, and PV and things like that. A high carbon price is not $50 a tonne. What Sweden has at $200 a tonne is a high carbon price. So if you want to entertain a high carbon price, I'd agree. We can go carbon price model. But I don't think anyone's seriously talking $200 a tonne in Australia. So feed-in tariff is the way to do it, because the thing about renewables, which are true zero emissions technology, zero carbon power technology, is that the price at the moment is high, but with a small amount of installation, you can get the price down significantly before you do your larger amount of installation. So you actually need to help them ride the cost reduction curve by early support. But it's not about propping them up over time. It's about actually subsidising them down or investing in getting them down the cost curve. And we've seen that it works. It's proven. It's worked with photovoltaic. We've seen massive change in Germany in the last 18 months with 42% reduction in their subsidy level, and still thousands of megawatts of photovoltaic going out there. We're seeing it in Spain, where the new solar thermal fit will be 30% lower, and so on. So we're seeing it with wind, and that's what happens. And here's an interesting thing on emissions trading schemes. This is from Hans-Josef Fell, along with Hermann Scheer, introduced the Renewable Energy Sources Act. Hermann Scheer is from the SDP, which is the equivalent of the Labor Party. And he shows that in under the Renewable Energy Sources Act in Germany, they actually got equivalent abatement of 57 million tonnes at a cost of 4.3 billion euros. Now, one of the reasons for that is called the merit order effect. And if you artificially wedge renewables into a grid, you start bumping off other vendors and you depress the price of energy. So effectively robbing the incumbents of some of their income and their dirty, they're running dirty assets that should be closed down anyway. So the actual cost of the Renewable Energy Sources Act was pretty low when you compare it to the European Emissions Trading Scheme, that in 2 years instead of 1 year of that, only had a CO2 saving of 8 million tonnes at a cost of 5.6 billion euros. So directly driving renewables is a much better deal because of the fact that you're riding the cost curve and because of the merit order effect, where you're wedging that into the market and depressing the price by making that commodity of electrons more available than what the demand is. And that's a valid thing that's happening with feed-in tariffs around the world. And you get screaming from RWE and E.ON, which is their version of AGL and Origin, but they just live with the screaming and the government pushes through. The Renewable Energy Sources Act is the suite of things that surround the feed-in tariff mechanism. So make that clear. That's the feed-in tariff. And we need to be careful. The feed-in tariff in name only won't do the job. We need a feed-in tariff that adds the cost of it to the electricity price stack. It doesn't come out of government coffers if you're going to go this route. It needs to guarantee access for anyone who proposes a project to the grid, and the cost of upgrading the grid needs to be borne on the electricity price stack portion that is allocated to grid. And that doesn't happen today with the portfolio standard, with the RET, with what we do get wind from. Second thing is that, let me be clear, that AGL and Origin are going to tell us, in fact, AGL's planning on releasing a paper to say how regressive, socially regressive, feed-in tariffs have become. Now, it's funny that AGL is joining the ranks of Salvation Army and St Vincent's in advocating for the poor, and you might wonder why. Well, they want to claim that feed-in tariffs are socially regressive because they don't like them. They like portfolio standards, which is RET, because they get to choose who they buy renewable energy certificates off, who they give an offtake agreement to. And so they if you just put on the price stack, they can't profit from that. Whereas if they can decide whether they do a project in-house or if they can play one vendor off another for an offtake agreement, they can make a bigger margin. So they want control. They don't want to lose control of being the monopoly suppliers of black energy and so on. So they will tell us how they'll suddenly be champions for the poor and that, but really they just don't want feeding tariffs because it threatens their business model. So it's our choice today whether we install 1 square metre of mirror service and don't burn 20 tonnes of coal. Or to put it another way, if we choose not to install 1 square metre of mirror service, we're choosing to burn 20 tonnes of coal. Well, I think there's a process to be followed, and we're trying to work from where we're weakest and where we're most vulnerable. And, if I walk down the Bourke Street Mall or Martin Place or something and I vox popped someone, I said, "Do you love solar?" And they'd say, "Yeah, we love solar." And that could be 80, 90% of responses. And then you say to them, "Oh, but what are you going to do when the sun doesn't shine? If you're talking wind, the wind doesn't blow." And then they pull down into their hole, Like, "Oh, yeah, okay. Sorry, I spoke out." But if we've had significant, not as big as they should be, but we've had significant subsidies and announcements around renewable energy targets and, amounting to billions of dollars worth of investment, even when the public didn't have the confidence that this could go ahead. Now, if you didn't care about climate change and you took a rational decision on Australia's energy security, you just go coal and gas, okay? Like, would that be clear? If you didn't care about the pollution and so on, that's a cheap thing to do. So the government seems to be beholden to fossil fuel interests, and, you know, like you said, we're outgunned. And so the reason that we have the renewable energy targets in Australia, which is different than the sole reason, it's the sole reason as opposed to what's happening in Europe, is that there's been public agitation for it. Okay, so public agitation achieved, say, $20 billion worth of spending in the area. So what if that public had the confidence that you can get the whole job done? Then how much more would they be demanding? And they'd be demanding for more. Because before, even myself, I used to say, we need more wind power and more solar power. And someone asked me how much, and I wasn't quite sure. Just more. Okay? And that's not a very strong arguing position. The nuclear guys come in and go, obviously their position's weakened somewhat recently, but they come in and say, well, we can, you know, stop all that window dressing crap. We can build 10 reactors, job done, and off they walk. And you're not actually that strong against that argument. But if you can say, really scary, dangerous, because I mean, most of their argument is you have to go nuclear because there's no other option, right? So that's stage one. We're doing that. We're killing the baseload myth, okay? We're putting that one to death, gone. You know, we don't want to hear about it anymore. And then moving on to other things like trying to describe the fact that subsidies aren't supporting for good, showing that they're actually just supporting or riding the cost curve. And so there's a whole lot of things to do there. Then the culmination of either a shock around the world where climate science is actually accepted or a massive spike in oil price could actually cause something like this to just be taken off the shelf and then run with. But otherwise, we just need to build up a massive community base. And what we're doing is we're training 1,000 public speakers. So if you want to join in, we'll arrange training in Canberra, put your name down. And when we've got 20 people, we'll come up here and we'll do 3 or 4 weekends. And then you can do, so that, you know, 80% of the job I'm doing, but take it out to every Apex club, Probus club, sports club, church faith group, and get the message right out into the people. Because we can't pay $100 million, threat of $100 million for an advertising campaign, but we can do $100 million worth of advertising by leveraging people in town halls, you know. Look, basically, Hot Rocks Geothermal, in fact, Origin have virtually confirmed it by writing down their investment, but it was very speculative. They like to talk about a huge resource. There's actually not a huge amount of conventional geothermal around the world. There's only 10,000 megawatts of conventional geothermal around the world. So Australia has about, you know, 25 to 30 gigawatts of what you'd call, you know, baseload capacity, and globally there's only 10,000 megawatts of geothermal. Of Hot Rocks kind of geothermal, there's a pilot plant in Germany of about 1.5 megawatts, you know. So it's pretty speculative. They don't talk about how, they like to talk about the resource being massive, but the difference between the sun and geothermal is actually not renewable energy, it's from the Earth's core. But they pump the water down, hope that it returns after they do fracking and things like that. Even when it does return, after a period of time, they actually draw down on the local resource. They like to, like an example was, I was listening to a thing on background briefing about it, and they were saying how, oh, this heat's been trapped down there for eons. Well, that's the point. It's been trapped down there. You pull it out, it's not trapped anymore. And the recharge rate is rather slow from like decaying radioactive isotopes and things like that. So actually, their business plan is at year 10, they have to go off and drill the next bunch of wells, and they get further and further and further from where the steam turbine is, and they just keep drilling forever. And you're talking 5 kilometres. Risk-wise, you need 90 wells per 500 megawatts, which is what they were talking about. And they're doing hydrofracking, so they're creating earthquakes, and they say, oh, well, because in Basel, Switzerland, they did it and they had to cancel the program. They say, oh, there's no one living out in, was it Innamenka or whatever. The point is they've just gone and put the world's most expensive wells in, and you get seismic activity and the wells go, you know, 2 kilometres down. You'll drill them all again at $70,000 a day, and it takes 3 months to drill one, 24/7, provided you don't drop your plug in the hole or something. This is not easy like a solar farm or a wind turbine that just goes up.
So why hasn't Australia invested anything seriously in the solar farm concept?
Well, I think it's because of the fossil fuel industry's clout, you know. I mean, solar flagships, we were in with Martin Ferguson and his advisors, the guy who writes his speeches, and we were explaining exactly,
you know, everything about solar thermal, we haven't changed our position really. We had it back about 2 years ago. We pretty much were on a fairly similar position and we explained it all. And they almost reverse engineered what we said and did the opposite in the solar flash. It's almost like, I felt like we scored an own goal telling them what to do. if those guys are telling us to do it, we better do the opposite, you know. And I just did all their work for them because that's what they came up with. So, and I think that's because there are, you know, it's either scared of fossil fuel interests. This is like killing the golden goose. You don't kill the golden goose, and the golden goose is exporting coal and gas out the ports, you know. And so everyone's got to protect that golden goose, and it's sitting in the back of everyone's psyche, and the politicians are shit scared and so on. So, you know, we have to address the fossil fuel industry has huge power, and you need to think of that in terms of when you compare to Europe, because Europe's in a slightly different situation where there's more energy security problems with imported oil and gas. But that said, don't think that that's their only driver, because in Germany they have much, much bigger lignite or brown coal resource than Australia has, and they could run Germany for hundreds of years, but they choose not to develop that kind of really poor burning coal. So, yeah, but Spain has, you know, more so than Germany, but they don't have lignite. Their coal's pretty much run out almost, and they import coal, they import gas. Right now the fight is the same fight we have here. It's renewables versus gas, and I think that's the fight that's here in Australia. It's exactly the same now. But the driver originally in Spain was that they'd run out of fuels. So that plus a concern of climate change. But I'd say that, you know, it's probably 60% the energy security, 40% climate, taking climate change seriously. In Spain, they installed pipelines to Algeria, and this is exactly what happens. Once they installed those and they got the contracts, they wanted to run those gas plants flat out. So the gas industry's lobbying like crazy to try and specifically stop the solar thermal with storage industry, because wind is okay for them because they can sell in the gaps. And so solar thermal with storage is a direct replacement for gas. And that's exactly why the solar flagships program has favoured plants that are hybrids with coal plants or hybrids with gas, because our government doesn't want to set a precedent of renewables doing the job of dispatchable power. So. At the moment, you've got, you know, political parties driven by focus groups, driven by advertising campaigns run by run by fossil fuel industry, but also driven by donations to political parties. Well, it's actually getting the word out there, because, you know, if I was Paul Howe from the AWU, who spruiks fossil fuels and uranium mining all the time, well, I'd get a gig on Q&A every day. But I'm not. So, you know, either we get a Paul Howe equivalent to be out there, or we do it the hard way, which is the way we've decided to do it as our hedge, and that is to train up, you know, initially 1,000 public speakers.
Well, I'll sign up for it.
So. Yeah, well, that'd be great. So 1,000 public speakers, if they all did 10 or 20 talks a year, you get out to like 400,000 or 500,000 people, okay?
That guy, Bjorn Lomborg, that media a couple of weeks back, he was saying, no, don't do that. Spend all the money on research and development to bring down the cost of renewables, so that governments and community are really going to want it.
Well, that's the position of the Australian government. That's the position of the Australian government, I reckon. It's, you know, trying to make an announcement here and there for money for geothermal or whatever's on the horizon but not here yet. Offer them a bit of money they can't attain and tell the public how good you are on renewables. It's unfortunately backed by some academics who are, you know, not willing to ask concurrently for money for research as well as to have programs to actually roll stuff out. So they try and turn it into research only, and that's really a bit of a disappointment and sort of does them in the end, because if you solar thermal research or PV research or something, you want to get research money, but if you actually get mass adoption by the public, well, then that inspires the government to give you more research money, I think. So you're actually better to have a two-pronged attack from their perspective. So, yeah, I think the simplified message is we need a carbon price. So you don't need to say high carbon price or anything. A carbon price and a major renewable energy program, okay? And then the next level of that, a major renewable energy program based on the successful feeding tariffs in Germany or something like that, you know? So it's a carbon price. Now, the carbon price, you say that, you'll basically get $10 to $20 a tonne. You don't need to necessarily say a low carbon price. But you want it to be $10 to $20 a tonne. You don't want it to be the dead zone of $25 to $70 a tonne. So that differs, I'll point out, that differs from the position of some environment groups that are asking from anything from $36 a tonne start price to $50 a tonne start price. So you might want to sort of check in what their rationale is as well. But we're pretty confident in our modelling that from $25 a tonne to $70, it will just get a mass mobilisation of gas. And I don't see what's innovation or changing the economy about that, because we've known how to build gas turbines for 50 years. So there's nothing new about installing gas turbines. So we don't want a recipe for the next generation of stranded assets. And that's what the $25 to $70 a tonne dead zone would be. be good if the, you know, if somehow you could earmark out some dispatchable, like get something like a 30 megawatt or a 50 megawatt solar thermal storage plant, get at least one of those in the region. You know, and in the region doesn't necessarily have to be exactly inside ACT, but there's locations you could put that to complement the solar and the nearby the solar PV and the nearby wind. So you've got your scenario, and then you know you wouldn't need to model it exactly that you hit the demand supply balance for the region, but you could sort of rough it in, and that'd be a pretty good outcome, I'd reckon.